Revolutionary greetings, Berkeley. Now, for me, it's always good to be in Berkeley, because Berkeley, the home of the free speech movement back in the 1960s, and it's right next to Oakland, where Huey and Bobby founded the Black Panther Party back in the day. A group that put revolution on the map for my generation. And then there's another part to the importance of Berkeley for me, and that's the fact that the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, Bob Avakian, his roots are here in Berkeley. He went to Berkeley High. He was part of the free speech movement, and he worked very closely with the Black Panther Party. So all of this comes together for the specialness of Berkeley to me. But today is an especially great time to be in Berkeley, because it's a time when young people are standing up. They're resisting things that they used to go along with. And they are questioning why things are the way that they are and what could be done about them. And this is very, very important, sisters and brothers, and I'm very glad to be out here in Berkeley. Y'all look real good from up here, and I understand that there's some other rooms where there's some other people who look pretty good, but I can't see them right now. But y'all in the house too. So all of this comes together around the importance of being in Berkeley. Look, I saw the video of folks out there in Sproul Plaza, standing up to the police, standing up to the administration, and got a real sense of inspiration for the sentiment that people had to not go along with business as usual, to not knuckle under to the powers that be, to stand up against inequality and injustice. See, and this movement that's spreading, this Occupy movement, points to the potential to bring forward and seize a different future for our youth. Because the future that this system offers our youth comes down to nothing better than being functionaries serving a global empire that is raining death and destruction on the planet. Right on, that's definitely the case. But we can and must seize a different future out of this madness of today. And in fact, I was talking to Doc as we were planning on this, and I was saying maybe we should change up the title. Just put a little handwritten Occupy up there so it says, "In the Age of Obama and Occupy, What Future for Our Youth?" Because this is a new situation that we're talking in. Now, to seize this potential to bring a different kind of future out, we got to address some important questions. We got to address questions like, what is it that we're up against? What kind of future society and world could we bring into being? And what is it we got to be doing now to be working on doing that? I want to go at some of that in my talk here today. And to do it, I'm going to start out by reading from Reflections on the Occupy Movement, a statement by Bob Avakian. And it goes, an excerpt from it goes like this. "To uproot and transform a society and indeed a world marked by and grounded in profound inequalities and relations of oppression and exploitation requires nothing less than an unprecedented revolution, a radical overturning of the entrenched and violently repressive ruling forces and imperial powers who now dominate human social existence, and the deep-seated economic, social, and political relations of exploitation and oppression of which they are the embodiment and enforcers. And to achieve such a radical overturning and transforming requires a scientific approach to the strategic orientation, program, and organization that is actually required for the revolution that is really needed. This revolution is necessary not only in order to deal with the basic and antagonistic relation in which the masses of people are ruled over by an exploiting class representing a small part of society, but also in order to transform the relations between different sections of people themselves." That's Avakian on the Occupy movement. Now, what I'm going to do from here is I'm going to take the two parts of what he said there. One is the thing that it's going to require nothing short of revolution to deal with all of this madness that we're up against. And I'm going to walk through that. And then I'm going to step to what kind of revolution we're talking about and what kind of leadership is needed for that. So what is it that we're up against? I mean, and we could just get a globe up here and spin it and then put our finger to wherever it stops. Let's put our finger on Central Africa. What would we find there? We would find millions of people living on the edge of starvation. We would find women facing mass rape. We would find horrific numbers of people being maimed and killed. Now, what's the cause of all of this madness? I mean, is it human nature? Is it the fact that these primitive Africans have descended into tribalism? No and no. The cause of all this mayhem that's going on in Central Africa today is a new 21st century scramble amongst rival imperialist powers vying for control over the natural resources and mineral wealth of that part of the world. That's what's responsible for those horrors. We could spin that globe again. Let's point our fingers to two places this time, South Asia and Eastern Europe. What do we find that ties those two together? What ties them together is 2.5 million women who are being trafficked as sex slaves. I'm not exaggerating here. This is reality. Women are being kidnapped. They're being deceived by people who promised them legitimate employment. They're being sold by boyfriends and even family to brothels and to men who use them for sex. See, and this is a horror that could not go down without actual collaboration from government officials in different parts of the world. Again, horrors woven into the fabric of capitalism. We could spin that globe again and come down to the US, the so-called best of all possible societies. This is a place where women are told they've achieved their equality. Yet for millions of women, life is replete with being battered, with facing rape, with facing being treated as if there's nothing but sex objects available for any man who wants to ogle them, talk about them, or even worse. But we could see even more here. We could look at gay people being demonized by right-wing politicians and preachers, being bullied, being beaten, and even killed, all for no other reason than that they dare to have intimate relations with someone of the same sex. We could look at immigrants, people who have come to this country in search of work and survival, but who find here Nazi-like laws that drive them to the margins of society, and La Migra raids that separate families and disappear people. And we would also find the brutal oppression that black people have faced from the time when the very first African was dragged to these shores in slavery chains. I'm going to talk about that a little bit. First off, I want to read another quote from Bob Avakian called Three Strikes. It gives us a historical perspective on this. The book by Michelle Alexander, The New Jim Crow, Mass Incarceration in the Age of Colorblindness, has shined a bright and much needed light on the reality of profound injustice at the very core of this country. And this brings me to a very basic point. This system in this country, in the whole history of its treatment of black people, what has it been? First slavery, then Jim Crow, segregation and Ku Klux Klan terror, and now the new Jim Crow, police brutality and murder, wholesale criminalization and mass incarceration, and legalized discrimination yet again. That's it for this system. Three strikes and you're out. Now I want to focus on and talk a little bit about that last part that he talked about, the new Jim Crow, police brutality, legalized discrimination, wholesale criminalization. But I want to get at what's behind that. What creates the situation out of which that came? See, and got to go back to the post-World War II period, when large numbers of black people left the rural South, migrating into cities across the country, looking for better opportunities for themselves and their families. Now, what they found was continued discrimination and employment in factories, but in the lowest paying, dirtiest, and most dangerous jobs. But then you come up to today, and even that has disappeared. Those factories have been mostly closed down, shipped halfway around the world by capitalists in search of greater profits through subjecting the workers in those lands to even more vicious exploitation than they could do to people here. That means that you've got people in these inner cities who are facing deprivation and punishment. Government economists project that fully half of inner city youth will never find legitimate employment. What does this mean? It means that a lot of our youth face futures of looking for some hustle or other to try to get by, fighting and killing each other, going in and out of prison, or maybe joining the military and becoming a killing machine for this system. That's the kind of future that our youth are up against. Now, we know a lot of our youth are into some bad stuff. We're clear on that. But we got to get clear on what's the source of this. What's responsible for this? And the reason we got to get clear on that is that we got a lot of people telling us it's the youth's own fault. You know, we got Bill Cosby. He says that poor black people are their own worst enemies. He says they have too many children out of wedlock. They don't speak proper English. The men wear their pants sagging down too far, and the women give their children ridiculous names. We also have today more heft given to this blame the poor chorus by President Barack Obama, and especially through his Father's Day speeches, where he says that absent dads are responsible for the problems that our youth face, or where he says that the reason that our youth don't get good education is because the parents won't turn off the TV and make them do their homework. So we got to get clear. Is it our youth's fault? Is it the parents' fault? Are poor black people at fault for this? Well, I see this all a different way, and the best way for me to get at it, I want to read a quote to you from Basics, a book of quotations and short essays from Bob Avakian, and something that I really encourage people to check out. The black people, the youth with their pants hanging down around their knees, their hats on backwards, their swagger, much of which I admire, weren't the ones who picked the jobs up and took them out of the ghetto. The people filling the prisons, the people in the gangs, weren't the ones who took the jobs and moved them away. They were not the ones who, when black people went chasing jobs, relocated them over the decades, discriminated against them, brought the police out to harass them, and made it very difficult for them to get a job and keep a job under those circumstances. None of that was done by the masses whom Bill Cosby so cheaply chooses to attack in this way. These were conditions that were caused by the dynamics of capitalist accumulation in its international dimension as well as within the country, and by conscious policies of ruling class politicians in line with this. That's Brother Avakian on who's responsible. And see, this is important because our youth are responding to situations that they had no control over and they had no complicity in putting into place. But at the same time that I acknowledge this, then I got to bring a challenge to our youth. You didn't create this situation, but you have responsibility to be part of the solution to this situation. You need to stand up. You need to resist these conditions that they bring down on you. You need to fight the power around them. And as you fight, you need to get out of some of that bad shit that you're in and get with the movement for revolution and join the Emancipators of Humanity, because you got responsibility to help us get all of our people out of this madness all around the world. And I think that's an important point that we got to take to people. See, and I've been talking some about the way in which the functioning of the capitalist system has brought this situation about. But there's also a mention in this quote about conscious policies of the ruling class. Well, what are those policies? Am I lying up here? No, I am not. Let's go through some of them. There's the 100-to-1 sentencing ratio for crack cocaine and powder cocaine. Our Congress, somebody else's Congress, because it ain't mine, passed a law that said that somebody who gets convicted of possession of 5 grams of crack cocaine, a drug which is widely used in the ghettos and barrios across this country, would get the same penalty as somebody convicted of possessing 500 grams of powder cocaine, a drug that more well-off people use. What are they telling you there? They're telling you that we are criminalizing people in the ghettos and barrios. We're going to throw the book at them. We're going to set the laws up so that it works that way. We could talk about stop and frisk, an official policy of the New York Police Department and police departments in a few other cities. This policy empowers the police to stop, demand identification from, and to search people for any reason or no reason at all. And in New York, they are on track, on a pace right now, to stop 700,000 people this year under stop and frisk. 5 out of 6 of the people they stop are black or Latino. And more than 90% of them were doing nothing wrong when the cops stepped to them and subjected them to harassment and humiliation and maybe a beat down and arrest and maybe even stole their life. This is what you could face through this. And again, it's targeted specifically at black and Latino youth. We also could talk about just the way that discrimination against blacks and Latinos is rife in the criminal justice system. The Sentencing Project did a nationwide study of the racial composition of people involved in drug cases. And here's what they found. They found that more than 60% of the people who get arrested for possession of illegal drugs are white. But then they tracked those cases as they went through the criminal justice system, and they found that when you got to who ended up in prison, 75% of the people who end up in prison for drug possession are black or Latino. We're just talking drug possession here. We're not talking about, you know, other crimes of violence. And drug possession is almost half of the people who are in jail, of the 2.4 million people who are in jail in this country. And less than 25% of the people who go to jail for drugs are white. So you start out with a majority white, but then you end up with a majority black or Latino. And the way you end up there is the discrimination that operates within the criminal justice system. And this is how you end up with racially targeted mass incarceration. 2.4 million people, most of them black or Latino, being warehoused in prisons across the country. That's how you get there. But then we also got to talk about how people are treated when they're in prison. And they're treated like less than human beings. They're fed food that's barely edible, subjected to arbitrary authority by the guards. Then you have the people who are in the segregation units, what California calls special housing units. These people are held in conditions that fit the international legal definition of torture. Because if you're held in one of those special housing units or SHUs, you are in conditions where you're denied human contact for days, weeks, sometimes months at a time. See, and I'm not just saying you don't get to have your phone call or visit from your families or your lawyer or something like that. They got it set up so you don't even see the person who brings you the food every day. You don't have contact with any other human being. And international law has defined that as torture and banned it for being employed against people who are in prison. But there are tens of thousands of people in prison in this country who are being treated exactly like that, being tortured exactly like that. See, and it's conditions like that that sparked the 2 hunger strikes that prisoners here in California in these special housing units waged over this summer. See, yeah, you got to give it up for that. You know, because this was some heroic action. People who had no other way to stand up and resist who starve themselves to stand up and say, we will not be treated like this anymore. And that was a very important thing and something that we should take note of, and I'm going to come back to later. Then we have to put on top of this the way people get treated when they're released from prison after they've served their sentences. What does that come down to? You get discriminated against when you go looking for employment. They got a box you got to check that you've been in jail. And checking that box usually means you don't get the job. And if you try to get by and don't check the box and they found out that you have been in jail, that's grounds for firing you. You're denied access to public housing, denied access to government loans. They don't even let you vote. That's what this comes down to. Now, when you put all of that together and link that to the overall discrimination that blacks and Latinos face in this society, it adds up to me like a picture of a slow genocide. And then when you figure the way things are going in this country and the way in which they're whipping up people to get behind even more stringent and vicious forms of punishment, I mean, I'm sure a lot of y'all saw that Republican debate where the moderator happened to mention that Governor Perry from Texas had presided over 134 executions, and the audience interrupted the thing by cheering. Well, people who are going to cheer when they hear that somebody has executed 134 human beings are people who would form a social base for even worse crimes and atrocities carried out against people. And my point in bringing this up is that slow genocide that I talked about could easily become a fast one. This is what we're up against. This is seriously what we're dealing with here. And we have to understand that the conscious policies that the ruling class of this country has developed in targeting black people and Latino people come from something. It comes from them remembering the 1960s. They remembered that back then it was the rising up of black people against the conditions that they faced that sparked a broader revolutionary movement that rocked this whole system back on its heels. They remember that, and they also realize that they're enforcing conditions in the inner cities across this country that are, if anything, worse than those in the 1960s. So they are moving to head off any potential rising up by trying to trap as many of our youth up in the criminal justice system as they can. In a certain sense, they are carrying out a counterinsurgency in advance of the insurgency, aimed at heading this insurgency off. See, so this is what we're up against, and what it comes down to is that there ain't no way you're going to deal with this short of making revolution and getting rid of the system once and for all. That's what it comes down to, sisters and brothers. That's what we're up against, and that's the way we got to move on it. See, and I know a lot of people felt like when they elected Barack Obama that they were doing something to deal with all of this. What black people were up against was going to be dealt with. Immigrants were going to get a decent shake out of this. The wars would be stopped. People thought all of that would go down, but they were wrong. Obama was stepping up to be the main representative, the commander-in-chief for the U.S. global empire. He said he was the best man to keep it in check, keep it in effect, and to keep it working. And see, if he's going to represent the U.S. global empire in everything that it does in this country and around the world, he cannot represent the interest and the needs of the masses of oppressed people here and around the world. That's an important lesson that people have to get, and then based upon getting it, need to act on it. Because see, here is what it comes down to, sisters and brothers, and if you get nothing else out of what I say tonight, I want you to get this. Yes, the world is a horror, a series of never-ending horrors. But things don't have to be this way. Through revolution, communist revolution, we could change all of this. We could end all of these horrors, all of this brutality that I've been talking about here and around the world. That's a fact. We could do that. There's more to it, though. These kind of revolutions have been made before. in China and in the Soviet Union before that, and they achieved many great things. Both of these revolutions have been overthrown, and now capitalism is back in effect in those societies. But the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party, Bob Avakian, has done a deep study of the previous revolutionary experience of those previous revolutionary societies. And through doing that, he's brought forward a new understanding of how to make revolution, and through that revolution to bring into being a socialist society that is both viable and is in transition to a world where exploitation and oppression has been ended once and for all, a classless communist world. Now, when I say this, I know that for some people, it's like, did I hear that right? Is that man up there talking about communist revolution and saying it's a good thing? Well, yes, I am. And before you say, he must be crazy, doesn't he know that communism failed, that it was a disaster everywhere it was tried? Well, I would ask you to do this. Consider what's the source of that conventional wisdom that communism has failed, and that it's the same people who don't tell you the truth about history, about the current state of society here in this country and around the world, and don't tell you about how it got that way. Those are the people who are telling you communism has failed, and they're lying to you about that too, sisters and brothers. Now, look, I want to get into what could be accomplished through revolution, and I want to get into concrete on it, but I don't have to, it's a big topic. I don't have time to go through all of it. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to take just one part of it. I'm going to talk about education, how education is handled in this society, and how it could be handled totally different in a revolutionary society. Now, for the rest of this, I'm going to suggest a website called thisiscommunism.org. And it will get you into the history of communist revolution, how it's dealt with things, both what have been its achievements, but also what's been its shortcomings, because that's an important part of what Avakian has done to bring forward this new understanding or new synthesis. He's fearlessly looked at where those previous revolutions went wrong, where they made errors, and why they made errors, and based upon that has come forward with a new understanding. But let's talk about education. Education should be about teaching people how to think critically, giving them the ability to understand reality and to act to change it. And it also should be about instilling in the youth values and an orientation that will inspire them to want to devote their lives to understanding reality and trying to change it. But you look at education in this society, it's geared in the exact opposite direction. In this society, education is crafted and twisted to serve the dictates of capitalism. It's used to justify and to perpetuate the oppressive and exploitative relations in society and to keep in effect the dominating positions of those already wealthy and powerful. Now, let me break down how some of this comes, and the place I got to start is with the content, because here's the first thing about it. Education in this society doesn't give people the true history of the world, how it developed, what it's like today, how it got that way. You don't learn that. Let me just give you a little example, because I was talking with somebody about the earthquake that happened in Haiti about 2 years ago. Now, when you looked on TV about that, you saw both the devastation of the earthquake, but also the grinding, intense poverty that Haitian people faced. But one thing you never learn in this society is, why is Haiti poor? The unspoken implication is, well, the Haitians are poor because they ain't got their shit together. You know, and then there are racial implications to that as well. All those black people, no wonder they can't do nothing right. That's what you get on that. But what you don't get is that when Haiti made its revolution more than 200 years ago and chased France, its colonial masters from France out, that was a very important revolution. But here's what happened. Right after that revolution, France put a stranglehold on Haiti, threw up a naval blockade. The United States helped enforce that naval blockade. And they said, until you pay reparations to France, you're going to be blockaded. We're going to strangle your economy. Now, why should Haiti have paid reparations to France? Well, because they had deprived France of their human property, the enslaved Africans of Haiti who rose up and made revolution. And they had deprived France of the wealth that it had gotten from stealing the labor of those enslaved Africans in Haiti, because Haiti was responsible for 80% of the wealth of the worldwide French Empire at the point before the revolution. They squeezed Haiti, forced them to pay those reparations. It was millions of dollars at that point, which would be billions and trillions of dollars today. That put Haiti's economy in debt, a debt that it never got out of. But they never tell you that. They don't tell you that Thomas Jefferson was way behind the U.S. helping France to strangle the revolution in Haiti. That's reality, but it's reality that you don't learn. We can go beyond that, because the other thing you don't learn about is the true significance of the twin original sins in the development of this country. And I can borrow a little bit of terminology from some other sources on that. What do I mean by these twin original sins? I'm talking about the genocide that was carried out against the native people and the enslavement of Africans here. Okay. Now, they have put that into the history course. Now, back when I was young, it was hard to find that in the history. But they have put the fact that those things happened into the history course, but you don't actually get the true significance of it. You don't find out that those twin original sins provide the foundation for all the wealth and power of this country. They don't bring that to you. And then here's one other telling exposure about education in this country. The simple, basic scientific fact of evolution is something that it is very controversial to teach people in this society. That's a telling exposure. Now, in some elite schools, there is encouragement for people to think in nonconformist ways, but even that is limited to things that don't challenge directly the fundamental interest of the capitalist rulers of this country. And when you come to education for those on the bottom of society, it's an even more cruel insult to those youth. I mean, you got millions of people in the inner cities in this country who go to schools that are more like prisons. Every morning when they go into school, they got to go through a metal detector. And then once they go through that metal detector, they see the halls of their school patrolled by actual police. And acting up in class in these schools, I mean, back in my day, we used to do that, you know, and they'd send us to detention for an hour. They'd give us a note to take home to our parents. This never happened to me, of course, but I saw it happen to other people. That's why I can tell you about it. But in school today, acting up in class could get you beat down and arrested by these cops who are patrolling the schools. This is what it comes down to. And despite the intentions, the good intentions of many of the teachers, these schools are set up to fail our youth, to push them out the door onto the streets, and to send them out with a message that it's their own damn fault that they're in those situations. This is what education comes down to in this society. Now, education could be totally different in a revolutionary society, and here's how I want to go at this. We in the Revolutionary Communist Party have produced a draft constitution for the new socialist republic in North America. This is a document that talks about what society would be like the day after the revolution. Okay, now we want to put this out, one, because we wanted people to know that society don't have to be organized this way. But two, we want to go on record for what kind of society we're bringing into being and how it would function and how it would work, so that people could look at what we're doing and saying, that stuff you're doing right now don't seem in line with that constitution you put out, because we want people to engage us over that stuff. That's a part of how we feel that we can stay on the road to what we're trying to pull off. Now, I can't give you everything, and I really encourage people to check this out, but I want to read some excerpts on this that will talk about how we'll approach this education. Here's one of them. Education, while valuing and giving expression to the circumstances and atmosphere that are favorable and conducive to learning and intellectual pursuit, shall avoid and combat an ivory tower environment and mentality. Education at all levels shall combine intellectual pursuits with various kinds of physical labor as part of working to transform the relation between intellectual and physical work so that this no longer constitutes the basis for social antagonism. Another excerpt. One of the most important purposes of the education system in the new socialist republic in North America is to enable students and the people broadly to learn deeply about the reality of and the basis for the oppression of whole peoples and the domination and oppression of women in the former imperialist USA and throughout the world. And just one more point I wanted to read. The educational system in the new socialist republic in North America must enable people to pursue the truth wherever it leads, with a spirit of critical thinking and scientific curiosity, and then in this way to continually learn about the world and be better able to contribute to changing it in accordance with the fundamental interest of humanity. See, now, and these aren't just some good ideas about how to do education different. This is based upon the actual difference that a socialist society has in relation to a capitalist society. In a socialist society, people are working together in common for the common good. They're trying to transform reality, trying to deal with contradictions left over from capitalism. They're not trying to protect private property and private holdings and wealth and power for a minority of people. To do this, you're going to need people to consciously and voluntarily change the world and themselves in the process. So you need an educational system that teaches people to think critically so that they can understand reality as deep as possible and on that basis contribute to transforming it. That's why a socialist society, a revolutionary society, could go at this question of education differently than a capitalist society. The other point I wanted to make is that the framework from which the approach to education, but everything that's in this Constitution, comes from the work that Bob Avakian has done to re-envision revolution and communism and how to bring it about. And that's an important thing that I wanted to get into here with people. Now, I've been talking about revolution, and I feel like I need to get to what is revolution. And to me, the best way to do it, I want to read a short quote from Avakian on that, again from Basics. It's important first to make clear what in basic terms we mean when we say the goal is revolution, and in particular, communist revolution. Revolution means nothing less than the defeat and dismantling of the existing oppressive state serving the capitalist imperialist system, and in particular, its institutions of organized violence and repression, including its armed forces, police, courts, prisons, bureaucracies, and administrative power, and the replacement of those reactionary institutions, those concentrations of reactionary coercion and violence, with revolutionary organs of political power and other revolutionary institutions and governmental structures, whose basis has been laid through the whole process of building the movement for revolution, and then carrying out the seizure of power when the conditions for that have been brought into being, which in a country like the U.S. would require a qualitative change in the objective situation, resulting in a deep-going crisis in society and the emergence of a revolutionary people in the millions and millions who have the leadership of a revolutionary communist vanguard and are conscious of the need for revolutionary change and determined to fight for it. Now, we're not at that point yet, but how would you get from where we are now to the point where such a revolution is possible, where such a revolution could be made? And this is something that we've addressed, and we've got a strategy statement that I also encourage people to check out. It's one of the essays in the book Basics that I was talking about before. Now, this statement says some things about why revolution could be possible in a society like this, but then it also poses, what is it that people who see the need for revolution need to be doing right now? And then it goes on to answer that question by saying, fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution is a big part of the answer. Now, what this means is building resistance in a way that enables people to raise their heads, to get a better sense of what they're up against, who the enemy is, but also who their potential friends and allies are, and what kind of struggle needs to be waged in order to win. See, and this also has a lot of implications today in the midst of Occupy Everywhere spreading across the country. Because you saw in this people standing up and resisting some of the economic deprivation that is being brought down on the great majority of people here. But as it developed, you also saw people connecting with other struggles. Like earlier this week, there was a conference in Arizona where some reactionary forces were getting together to plot even further attacks on the immigration movement. And what the Occupy forces in Arizona did is they laid siege to this conference. You know, and the police were there trying to defend these people, trying to come up with more cruel ways to come at immigrants. But the Occupy people were like, we ain't stepping back because this is part of what we got to deal with. I'm going to talk in a little bit about the relationship between Occupy Wall Street and the movement to stop, stop, and frisk in New York. But again, people seeing links between the different struggles, connecting the dots, as some people have said. This is an important part of what you can accomplish through fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. There's another thing that it talks about in the strategy for revolution piece that needs to be done by people who see the need for revolution. And that is that you need to spread revolution everywhere, and you need to spread the path-breaking leadership and work and vision of Bob Avakian, the leader of the Revolutionary Communist Party. Now, I already talked about the new synthesis of revolution and communism that Chairman Avakian has developed. But why am I talking, why do we talk about getting this everywhere? What's the significance of this? And see, just think about this. People are standing up. People are resisting, and people are questioning, why are things like this? Do they have to be this way? Could they be somewhere, some other way? Here you have a leader who has developed a framework and a guide that goes at that question in an all-around and comprehensive way that brings to you, in basic sense, an understanding of why the world is like this, but also a vision of how it could be totally different and far better. Now, think about the impact that this has for people who are standing up and questioning stuff to have this framework that they can bounce off of, that they can debate with, that they can develop points of agreement and points of disagreement with. Think of how this can spur forward that resistance and that questioning, because it will go at this sense that too many people have been suffocated with that things have to be this way, that there's no other way fundamentally that there can be. So the best you can do is make surface changes in the already existing setup. See, and in light of what we see as the importance of getting Avakian's work and his vision everywhere, the Revolutionary Communist Party has embarked on a campaign to raise big money, the money that's needed to get that work and that vision everywhere. And we encourage people to check this out. And I just want to read a short excerpt from a piece that we wrote on this. You can love and agree with most of what Bob Avakian has to say, or you can disagree with a lot of it, or you can just feel like you don't know enough yet to be sure one way or another, even as you find yourself drawn in and attracted by different elements. But if you're a decent thinking person, a person with a conscience, someone who just can't go along with the notion that it's acceptable for great social injustices to repeatedly be tolerated or swept under the rug, then this campaign is for you. See, so this is all part of what people who see the need for revolution need to be doing right now. Now, I want to step in closing, I want to step towards getting into again racially targeted mass incarceration. I already painted for you a picture of what it's like. This is a great injustice that needs to be stopped, and we are doing something to stop it right now. And when I say we, I can start with me and Brother Cornell, because he and I issued a call for a campaign of civil disobedience to stop, stop, and frisk. We did this because it's a pipeline to mass incarceration, and because it's just, frankly, it's fucking illegitimate, illegal, and unconstitutional. You know, and people should not have to put up with their rights being revoked because their skin happens to be black or brown. Now, when we did this, we was like, well, if it's just me and you, brother, we're going to go out there and do this. But we're going to call on other people to get with it. And when we issued the call for it and took it a lot of places, including places that some people thought we shouldn't, a lot of folk came together to take this thing up. We ended up with one thing that's developed around this movement against stop and frisk is a core of mostly younger people who are taking this up as their mission. You know, and they're debating right now whether they should call themselves the new freedom fighters or the new freedom riders. And, you know, there's a lively internet debate going on around this. And talk to me later if you want to get some of the, get in on it, you know. But these are young folks who are like, we got to do what they did in the 1960s. We got to put our bodies on the line. Joining together with these young folk, you got ministers, you got professors. We got a professional comedian. We even got one of the actors from The Wire who went and got arrested with us, as well as a bunch of other people. Now, I made this point about taking it places where some people thought we shouldn't, you know, because we said we should take it to Occupy Wall Street. And some folks said, them folks down at Occupy Wall Street, them white people, they don't know nothing about stop and frisk. And I was like, yeah, they don't, but they oughta. That's why we got to go down there, you know. And we went. And then we went back again, and we went back again. And through the course of this, some of those white people who knew nothing about stop and frisk learned about it and decided, like, this is horrible. I have to do something about it. There were also a couple of black and Latino folks who was hanging out down at Occupy Wall Street who, until we started bringing this, kind of felt like, well, I can't bring what happens to me down here because nobody will want to relate to that. But then when they saw people who were saying, let's stand up and do something about it, they joined in readily. And then them joining in helped to bring others. So that's how this core of younger people came together. And people are grappling with, where does this come from? How do we stop it? What's it got to do with the revolution? And that's a very important part of what's developed. Another important part of what developed through this is that folks in the projects, black and brown high school kids who were just tired of being jacked up and harassed by the police but thought there was nothing that could be done about it, when they saw these folks coming and going to the police precinct and doing civil disobedience and getting arrested, they were like stunned and then gladdened. They were like, did you see it? There was even a Jewish guy up there. No, and then they were high-fiving in the projects, and when the revolutionaries came back by, they were hugging them because they're beginning to dare to hope that something could be done about this shit that they're up against. They're not certain yet, but they're beginning to dare to hope. And that's an important part of what's got to happen if you're going to bring forward a movement for revolution, a movement that can transform all of this shit. So from what you got that happening from one end, you've got the people who didn't know about this injustice, but who are learning about it and acting to stop it. And see, this is what I'm talking about when I talk about fight the power and transform the people for revolution. We got to bring people forward to stand up and resist. We also got to bring to them the breadth of what they're up against. That it isn't just, if you want to talk about the 99%, what happens to all of them is all you can deal with. Because you got to deal with the oppression of women. You got to deal with what happens to gay people. You got to deal with the brutality that's coming down in the ghettos and barrios if you're really going to represent the interest of the overwhelming majority of people in this country and around the world. So this is what I'm talking about. And just on this mass incarceration tip, this is a fight that you all must join in and take up. This is not just a thing for New York. It is not just a thing for the people in prison. This is for anybody who sees injustice in the way that people are warehoused in prison, the pipelines that they use to get them there, and the less than human treatment that they get in prison and once they get out of prison. Students here have to join this fight. You've got to link up with people on campus and off campus to build it. And get with us on this, because we want to see this develop and we want to see determined resistance brought to this movement. It is very, very important. We got to stop this slow genocide. Don't even think about how it could become a fast one. Let's stop it where it is right now. That's something that we got to do. And let me say this, for my part, I'm going to be approaching it as part of building a movement for revolution, as fighting the power and transforming the people for revolution. And you got to get with this fight against mass incarceration, whether you agree with me on revolution or not. You got to get, if you don't agree with revolution, you got to agree with me that this is unjust and it must be stopped. But of course, if you do agree with me on revolution, you got even more reason to get into this, because building a revolutionary movement is something that this can contribute quite a bit to. Now, I'm really at the end, and I debated as to whether I should do this or not. There's something that we've been doing in New York around the stop and frisk thing. I'm going to try it here and see if it works. Y'all ready? Because y'all involved in this too. Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
Mic check.
No more generations of our youth.
Here and all around the world,
whose life is over,
whose fate has been sealed,
who have been condemned to an early death,
or a life of misery and brutality,
whom the system has destined
for oppression and oblivion.
Even before they are born.
Even before they are born.
I say no more of that.
I say no more of that.
And having said no more of that,
and having said no more of that,
we must act to make it real.
We must act to make it real.
Thank you, sisters and brothers.
Brother Carl Dix, it's good to see a revolutionary communist in the flesh, though, isn't it? I want to say that I'm blessed to be here. Each time I come to UC Berkeley, it's like I'm coming home. I grew up in Sacramento, California, right down the road, Route 5. My brother Clifton West held the mile record for freshmen for 38 years. Part of the 1972 NCAA track and field championship team with brothers like Eddie Hart and Isaac Curtis and a host of others. So each time I come to Berkeley, I'm already fired up before I even get to the lectern. And I want to thank my dear brother Carl Dix. A lot of people ask me, Brother Wes, why you spend so much time with revolutionary communists and revolutionary anarchists and prophetic Jews and prophetic Buddhists and prophetic Hindus and all those agnostics and atheists? You know you nothing but a funky Holy Ghost Black Baptist, brother. I said, yes, I'm a Jesus-loving free black man. And I come from a tradition that says lift every voice. And if you have the courage to accent truth, you're going to have to listen to every voice, because no individual, no group has a monopoly on truth. We need to listen to one another and learn from one another if we're going to organize and mobilize together. Shoot, I'll work with prophetic Mormons if they want to talk about corporate greed and wealth inequality and
the role of big money in politics and arbitrary military power and arbitrary police power. It has to do with what kind of human being you really are. What are you willing to sacrifice for? So if you're committed to truth, and the condition of truth is to allow suffering to speak. And if you're concerned about justice, and justice is what love looks like in public. So if you love poor people, if you love Jamal on the chocolate side of town, if you love Juanita on the Latino side of town, or Harry on the vanilla side of town, or on the Asian side of town, then you won't talk about justice. Because when you love folk, you can't stand the fact they're being treated unjustly. That's what we're here for. That's why I travel the country with this brother. Now, of course, we don't agree on everything. I think he's wrong on the God question. We're going to get into that later. That's all right. That's all right. And we look at the traditions of Bob Ovechkin and my dear brother Huey Newton and Bobby Seale. We got Erica Huggins here. Where is she? Where is Sister Erica? Where is Sister Erica? Stand, my dear sister. Where are you? Oh, I don't see you. Where is she? There she is. Put the camera on our dear Sister Erica Huggins, former head of the Black Panther Party, still long-distance runner, deep love, committed to truth, got a smile on her face, love flowing out of her soul. We love you. We love you. Yes, we do. Lift every voice. I don't know if Brother Marvin X is here, but I want to acknowledge that brother. I told him he could read his poem, but I don't know if he made it here or not. He's a student of the Honorable Elijah Muhammad. Produced Malcolm X. Transform a gangster named Malcolm Little into one of the greatest black freedom fighters of the 20th century. Malcolm X, lift every voice. He produced Minister Louis Farrakhan, lift every voice. Oh, I disagree here. I disagree there. We disagree with most of our professors. We disagree with most of our politicians. Can you keep track of the element of truth that's at work in their language and in their witness? Can you keep track of the element of justice that's in their work and in their witness? That's the challenge. I don't care if you're Palestinian. I don't care if you're Israeli. I don't care if you're Ethiopian. I don't care if you're Guatemalan. If you have the courage to allow suffering to speak, and you're concerned about the sources of social misery, and you see the connection between unjust social structures and unfair structures of domination generating unnecessary social misery, then you're already on the love train. Oh, yes. We need the OJs, don't we? You're already on the love train. And that's my tradition. John Coltrane's a love supreme. It's Curtis Mayfield. It's Aretha Franklin. There's a genius born just down the road named Sly Stone in Vallejo. What did he say? Stand. You've been sitting much too long. There's a permanent crease in your right and wrong. Stand, they'll try to make you crawl because they know what you're saying makes sense and all. Stand, there's a midget standing tall and the giant beside him about to fall. Stand, there's a cross for you to bear, things to go through if you're going anywhere. Those are not just words to titillate and stimulate. Too many of our young folk are tied into this culture of superficial spectacle where they're told to be human is to be titillated and stimulated. So they become addicted and self-medicated to keep them sleepwalking. No, the Occupy movement is about the awakening. It's about the deep democratic awakening. About those Sly Stone call everyday people. Or those of late J. James Cleveland call ordinary people. If you're fundamentally committed to the preciousness and the pricelessness of ordinary people and everyday people, I don't care what color, I don't care what culture, what civilization, what sexual orientation, it's a human thing. But it begins with those catching hell, those Franz Fanon called the wretched of the earth. And the problem has been in the last 30 years that the framework for those who love poor people and love working people has been pushed to the side. This ice age we have been living in, where it's fashionable to be indifferent to poor people. That's why our children, can you imagine? 42% of our precious children of all colors live in or near poverty in the richest nation in the history of the world. That's moral obscenity. That's an ethical abomination. Every American ought to be ashamed to live in a nation where the precious youth of whatever color has to deal with that level of social neglect and economic abandonment. And it's tied to greed, especially corporate greed at the top. So we need to talk about oligarchic power, plutocratic power, billions of dollars at the top, trillions given to those at the top because they too big to fail. As if our precious young people are too little to be highlighted. I don't know about you, I'm tired of that hypocrisy. Investment bankers get in trouble and call for welfare and get trillions of dollars, and our poor brothers and sisters call for help and they're told to be responsible and deal with the consequences of your actions. Nothing but hypocrisy and mendacity. True. Well, the poor brother on the corner gets caught with a crack bag and goes to jail for 7 years, but those on Wall Street and got involved in criminal behavior, insider trading, market manipulation, predatory lending, not one has been investigated or prosecuted. That's arbitrary rule of law. You can't have a society that holds together if you don't come to terms with arbitrary rule of law. And our young folks see it. Our young folks see it. They saw it in the 1980s as Reaganism began to move in. That's why they came up with gangster rap. Where does gangster rap come from? Looking at old folk and saying, oh, you're acting gangster-like. They looked at Wall Street and saw gangster activity. They looked at the White House and saw selections rather than elections. The Supreme Court's deciding against popular votes. They looked at politicians and said, my God, Congress seems to be a site of legalized bribery and normalized corruption with 26 lobbyists for every congressman or congresswoman. They said, everybody's concerned about the 11th commandment, thou shalt not get caught. Get over by any means. That's what our young folks saw. They looked at our churches and saw CEOs rather than pastors. Thank God for J. Alfred Smith and Alan Temple. Prophetic. Used to be a time where somebody was concerned about non-market values like love and justice and fairness and fidelity and integrity and dignity and magnanimity. But no, not by the time we get to the early part of the 21st century. Everybody's for sale. Everybody for sale. Just give them a high bid. Give them big money. Thank God for my dear Sister Alice Walker. Where is she? Where is Sister Alice Walker? Where is Sister Alice Walker? Where is she? Stand, my dear sister. Stand. There she is. Oh, we love you. We love you, Sister Alice. We love you. You've taken a stand all these years. From gut bucket Jim Crow, Mississippi, to this very day, you're still telling the truth in your own literary way. Oh, yes. Because I believe in the Sankofa bird. I refuse to move forward without looking backward and seeing the freedom fighters of the past who held up the highest standards. The Toni Morris and the Ishmael Reeves, the Amir Barakas, all of them in their own way. They said, well, Brother West, do you fully agree with any of them? No. I'm a jazz man. I don't want everybody to imitate me. I want them to find their own voices. Imitation is suicide. Emulation is a sign of an immature mind. Be yourself. Have the courage to be yourself. And then we overlap. That's the best of the history of black people in America. People don't like to talk about blackness these days, especially in the age of Obama. Everybody's colorblind. Oh, my dear brothers, good God, it's good to see this, brother. Stand up, Brother Iman, stand up. You all know this, Brother Iman here. Stand up, this brother, prophetic Islamic brother. I didn't know you were in the audience, man. I did not know. We were just in San Francisco together. We were just on stage at Laney College together. legacy of Malcolm X. We're about to know, how do you reconcile prophetic Islam with radical democracy? But there's a brother named Malcolm X. And this brother right here is in the grand tradition. But we don't look deep enough. And it's mainly because we are afraid. We're scared of taking seriously the contribution of black people in this nation. Afraid of it. And it has nothing to do with phenotype. It has to do with courage, vision, presenting an alternative world. The great Shelley used to say poets are the unacknowledged legislators of the world in that grand pamphlet. And what did he mean by that? He wasn't talking about versifiers. We heard magnificent poetry. But they weren't just reading verses or saying verses. To be a poet in the most profound sense is to have the courage to unleash your imagination and your empathy. So it's connected to your R-O-O-T-S, your roots, and the R-O-U-T-E-S, the routes for which you go. And if you keep your R-O-O-T-S consolidated and tight, but keep Socratic energy there for self-criticism, then you can go to any corner of the globe, you can go to any nook and cranny of the nation, you can go to a crack house, White House, your mama's house, you still got integrity, you still got dignity, you're still on fire for justice, you still want to tell the truth. Young people are hungry and thirsty for truth and justice. They're tired of the lies they have been bombarded with. They're tied with the dominant culture of clever gimmicks of mass weapons of distraction. See brother Vincent there, stand up there, brother. Wrote the classic on funk music. James Brown, George Clinton, Bootsy Collins, Confunction from Vallejo, Watts 103rd Street Rhythm Band. And I aspire to be a funk master. Because the funk is about the truth tied to what Samuel Beckett called the mess. What it is to be in time and space, what it is to be in history, the wounds and bruises and scars that all of us have as human beings, and the fact that we all emerge in the funk, namely our mama's womb, but all that blood down there. And some stinking stench. And that one day our bodies will be the culinary delight of terrestrial worms. That's funky too. You're gonna die. And in that move from mama's womb to tomb, what kind of person are you going to be? You ought to come to terms with forms of suffering, come to terms with forms of social misery, and be willing to straighten your backs up. And anytime every day people straighten their backs up, they're going somewhere, because folk can't ride your back unless it's bent. And that's what's happening today. Folk are straightening up. Tired of wearing the mask, I want to be me. Tired of laughing when it ain't funny and scratching when it don't itch. Oh yes, for the last 35 years, we've told young people in every corner of this nation to do what? Be successful, be successful, be successful. What does success mean? Material toys, title, wealth, power, and being well-adjusted to injustice. Well-adjusted to injustice, well-adapted to indifference. Is that success? I'm old school. My tradition told me to be great. And he or she is greatest among you has to do with the quality of your service to others and the depth of your love for others, beginning with our great gift of our Jewish brothers and sisters to the world, the prophetic tradition. Yes, it's there in Egypt, it's there in Africa, it's there in Asia, but the whole tradition of a set of conversational partners like Micah and Amos and Isaiah and Nahum and so many others saying, to be human is to engage in hesed, loving kindness to orphan, widow, fatherless, motherless, poor, weak, vulnerable. That is a profound contribution. And it's no accident that black people in this particular democratic experiment and empire, because it's simultaneously both, isn't it? For our indigenous brothers and sisters, 1492 inaugurated World War I has been going on ever since. Let us never lose sight of the preciousness of our indigenous brothers and sisters. But at the same time, you had some urban guerrillas who were anti-imperialist. I'm anti-imperialist too. That's why I'm critical of the imperial policies of the United States. It's a question of principle. How come you don't get behind politicians? I get behind principles. I evaluate politicians in light of the principles. Well, if they're black and brown, do you kind of tilt toward them because of that ethnic thing? I'm very, very excited when I see black and brown and yellow folk breaking white supremacist barriers based on principle. Because I hate white supremacy, just like I hate male supremacy. I hate anti-Semitism. I hate anti-Arab racism. I hate anti-Muslim view. I hate homophobia. But at the same time, even when they break those barriers, I want to know what they are doing. What your policies look like? Does it reflect what Amos was talking about when he said, let justice roll down like waters and righteousness like a mighty stream? Are you concerned about working people here and around the world? And especially are you concerned about the poor children whose voices rarely get a chance to surface? Thank God for Marion Wright Edelman, been struggling for the last 45 years for our children. What future for our youth? They are 100% of the future. So, Brother West, what are you calling for? Well, one, let me say this, that I am excited about the Occupy movement. I was just in dialogue this with Brother David D. Where's Brother David D? Stand up, Brother David D. He's one of the great freedom fighters here. One of the great freedom fighters around here. Love this, brother. And why am I excited? Because it's led by young people. More of them know Lupe Fiasco than they do Donny Hathaway. You need to know both. They know Erykah Badu more than Nina Simone. They need to know both. You need to know about Carole King, James Taylor, Bob Dylan, Peter Seeger. Have a sense of history even as you make history in the present. And it's a beautiful thing for an old school brother like me to see young people disproportionately straighten up their backs and standing the way Sly Stone said, stand in that poetic way of exercising your imagination and your empathy. And you're saying, like my dear brother Carl Dix, we refuse to accept the notion that there's no alternative to the present. We will not defer to the truncated public discourse that says the only limits of our politics is a choice between a mean-spirited, mediocre, mendacious Republican Party and a milquetoast and spineless Democratic Party. We refuse to confine ourselves to that kind of limit. We want something else. We want another world. We want a better world. We want more imagination. We want more empathy. And they say, oh, that's just utopian. You're just dreaming. What's wrong with dreaming? Eugene O'Neill, one of the greatest playwrights in word, just like Stephen Sondheim is our greatest playwright in song. He used to say oftentimes the question of either you dream or you die. And by dreaming, I'm not talking about some kind of cheap utopianism. I'm talking about how you generate hope. And again, I come from a people, black folk, where for so long, the hope was a crime. Can you imagine what it's like? 244 years of slavery. For the very notion of dreaming, end up executed, or later on under Jim Crow, swinging from a tree. Or even in the 1960s, when you really dream like Martin, the FBI keeps track of you every day from January 1956 until your day you die, and you discover that the very photographer with you every day was an FBI informant. Dream or die. And it has to do with the depths of your love. If you're willing to love, you can't help but dream alternative visions to a nightmarish present and may be confined solely to your side of town, but you're like the canary, sooner or later, it's gonna hit vanilla suburbs too. Brother Tavis and I were on the poverty tour. We started, in fact, that was the condition under which I went. I would go. I said, Brother Tavis, the idea is magnificent, but we must start on an Indian reservation. We went to the reservation and asked our red brothers, what do you think about recession? They said, what recession? Well, you know, they got 9.1 unemployment in larger society. Oh, Lord, we've had 40 for decade after decade after decade after decade. Go to the barrio with our Latino brothers and sisters. They say it's 18-19. We know they're not telling the truth. You count the folk who's giving up looking for jobs. Count the folk who are working part-time. Go to the black section of town. What recession are you talking about? It's only a recession now because it's affecting disproportionately our precious white brothers and sisters. Let's be honest about it. If we really in it together, then when it affects one of us, it affects all of us. I don't care what color you are. I don't care what your own cognitive commitments are. And that's what is magnificent about this movement. No one predicted that people would be talking about corporate greed and wealth inequality, let alone right-wing brothers and sisters on Fox News. Brother Bill O'Reilly, now he's got to somehow defend Wall Street now. I haven't seen any criminal behavior whatsoever. We haven't investigated, brother. We can't investigate. Ask the Justice Department to do it. Justice Department won't even investigate the torturers from the last administration. They won't investigate the wiretappers from the past. And you know the wiretaps got us. I turn on a little Luther when I hear some things going on. I believe in spreading the good stuff. But it's also important to laugh, though, isn't it? That's why the blues is tragic comic, not just tragic. It deals with incongruity. It's the first time a black person ever spoke to large numbers of free black people. 1837, Henry Highland Garnett, he stepped up, he said, never confuse the situation of black people with that of the Israelites of the Old Testament or Hebrew scripture. For black people, pharaohs on both sides of the bloody Red Seas. You got to be tragic comic. You got to sing a song. But keep on pushing the way Curtis talked about. Just sing a song to keep the spirit going. You see, the Occupy movement now is in a stage where it's getting blues-like. Because the attacks are becoming more vicious. The lies are becoming thicker. You're going to have to learn something from a blues people. You're going to have to learn how to preserve hope and give up your cheap optimism. Hope and optimism qualitatively different. It's going to have something to do with the depths of your commitment. It's going to have something to do with the very young people that Brother Carl Dix was talking about. The ones locked into the military-industrial complex. We've spent $300 billion in the last 28 years. It's called a Marshall Plan, but it's a penal-carceral Marshall Plan. They told us they didn't have a Marshall Plan for education, didn't have a Marshall Plan for housing, didn't have a Marshall Plan for jobs with decent wage, but they found $300 billion for a carceral penal Marshall Plan for jails, prisons, and the criminal justice system. Thank God for Angela Davis and so many other folk who have been highlighting this issue. Oftentimes, voices in the wilderness, but now coming to the center. And we got to make the connection between that military-industrial complex, highly racialized, but also tied to our poor white brothers and sisters. One of the fastest groups undergoing incarceration, poor white. And sisters who are poor, absolutely. Absolute disproportionate black and brown sisters. Yes. But we got to connect that military industrial, the prison industrial context with the military industrial complex. You see? Because the military budget also is a major priority. We have no money, but here comes Iraq. We have no money, but here comes Afghanistan. Always find the money there. Not for the children, not for the workers, not for the poor. Warped priorities. Warped priorities. And then the drones, human acts, dropping bombs on innocent people. Well, we're trying to kill terrorists. Why you killed their daughter? That little daughter's precious. The daughter of a terrorist of whatever color is precious. 4 years old, 5 years old. She's not responsible for the choices of her father. She ought not never to be killed. I don't care which government does it. And once you move down the path of collective punishment, the next thing you know, you become so callous. Your soul has become so chilly. Your conscience has become so coarsened. Your heart has become so hardened that you start talking about them in terms of collateral damage rather than precious human beings. That's part of the imperial policy. We've got to talk about that. And sometimes our young folk, the only major choice they make is in the military. Then we connect it to the corporate oligarchic complex on Wall Street and corporate elites, where the wealth is hemorrhaged at the top. 1% of the population owning 40% of the wealth. The top 400 individuals in America have wealth equivalent to the bottom 150 million. Now that for me was a key sweat moment. Something just ain't right. I know Brother Ice is here somewhere. Where's Brother Ice? Where's Brother Ice, the hip-hop artist? Is he still here? Where is he? There he is. Get his brother a hand. Get his brother another artist. Serious artist. Just like Lupe Fiasco and the others. And I keep pointing out the artists because you have to play. Artists must play a fundamental role in this movement. Got to play a fundamental role in this movement. Because when you talk about what we're up against, you better have your spirit fortified. You better have your soul so determined that nothing can turn you around. And you ought to be focusing on the love. The Occupy movement is a love movement. It's not hating anybody. When I give a critique of oligarchy, I'm not talking about hating oligarchs. I'm talking about the use of oligarchic power, which is a choice. It is a decision. We're not demonizing anybody. We are demonizing systems. That's why none of us are purely part of the solution. We're all shot through with contradictions. There's white supremacy inside of me. There's male supremacy inside of me. There's homophobia inside of me. I've got to work it through. I've got to wrestle with it. That's where the courage to imagine and empathize plays a fundamental role. So don't let anybody tell you the Occupy movement is about hatred and revenge. There's a qualitative difference between justice and revenge, and you don't have to read Shakespeare's The Merchant of Venice to know the difference. But it's a nice text to read. Powerful text for the distinction. Powerful text. I'm going to bring this to a close. But you can see where I'm headed. Namely, it is the beginning of a new day. The conservative era is coming to a close. Free market fundamentalism has failed. Neoliberal policies here and abroad are morally bankrupt. They have no future if you're concerned about poor and working people. And the challenge is first to shatter the sleepwalking. That's the first thing we have to do. In that sense, the Occupy movement is already victorious because it has shattered sleepwalking. Everybody's got to talk about corporate greed. I don't care where you come from. I don't care who you are. You could be right-wing crypto, right-wing centrist, neoliberal, or revolutionary. That's a beautiful thing. In America, America is a place that often is afraid of the truth when it comes to allowing suffering to speak. It's true. Look at the U.S. Constitution. No reference to the institution of slavery. 22% of it happens in the 13 colonies. They're very labor producing the wealth, the precondition for American democracy. No reference to that institution. And you're going to end up fighting a civil war over an institution not invoked in your Constitution. That's called chickens coming home to roost. You reap what you sow. And if it wasn't for Frederick Douglass and Harriet Tubman, William Lloyd Garrison, and so many others, they say, you know what? Given all of this rage that's surfacing, just like in the Occupy movement, it's at a fork in the road. You can either go toward anger, revenge, bigotry, or you can go toward love, justice, and equality. That has been the fundamental role of the black prophetic tradition from Frederick Douglass to A. Philip Randolph to Ida B. Wells Barnett to Fannie Lou Hamer to Ella Baker to Martin Luther King Jr. to Stevie Wonder. I know his music was playing when we came in. How is it that when these black peoples who have been terrorized and traumatized and stigmatized for so long, hated for so long, keep dishing out all of this love? That's a fundamental question. That's what I love about Carl Dix. Y'all might look at him and see just a communist. I look at him and see a black man who loves poor people and working people, and he's working out his alternative vision, and he's been true to it for the last 45 years. And even if I disagree with X and Y, I can keep track of the love. And that's what we need to do to each and every one of us. Because if you have courage, you're going to manifest some of that love tied to justice. Talk about the Middle East the same way. Where's the love? Our Jewish brothers and sisters jumping out of the burning buildings of Europe, landing on the backs of Arab brothers and sisters. How do you talk about a love for our precious Jewish brothers and sisters on the one hand who've been hated for so long, hungry for security, and at the same time, they know their very prophetic tradition leads them to talk about justice. Yes, justice for precious Palestinian brothers and sisters too. Let's just be honest about it. Keep both at the same time. You can love both of those folk. Keep track of that love on both sides, but keep at arm's length the lies on both sides. That's what we're talking about. That's what makes this movement so beautiful. And I want to come to a close on this note of hope. Because it's precisely when we lift our voices and engage that we indirectly and directly empower each other. And the empowerment is not a pat on the back. It's an unsettling. It's like that first line in Henry David Thoreau's Walden. What can I do to wake my neighbors from their sleepwalking? That's what lifting your voice is all about. It's like line 24A in Plato's Apology, where Socrates says, the cause of my unpopularity was my parisia, my plain speech, my fearless speech, my unintimidated speech, my frank speech that had to do with that which was calling into question those assumptions and presuppositions that had blinded people for so long, generated deliberate ignorance for so long. But once that suffering began to haunt them, they needed empowerment, and they started looking for folk who've been Socratic and prophetic and tragicomic and blues-like. Thank God for the Occupy movement.